Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government, Monday, January 22, 2007, 8:30 a.m., Hearing Room H-170.
This is Monday, January 22nd. The opening salvo from the subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee on General Government. And we have a few comments or announcements, I think. First, with that, I'll ask Dallas to inform us a little bit as to what our marching orders are.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dallas Wyman with Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm the committee scheduler, and you'll be seeing a lot of me in this subcommittee, as almost all of my agencies are administrative and assigned to this subcommittee. I have underneath your agenda, you should have kind of an overview and outline of some of the protocol for the subcommittee. We've got some procedural issues. This subcommittee meets from 8:30 to 10. As you know, the chair likes to start on time, and I would imagine we'll gavel in about then. We have attached the general rules for Ways and Means. They apply to subcommittee. You have three Senate members and five House members, so to report anything out requires two I votes from the Senate and three I votes from the House. And then the bill is for the full committee, where it will be carried by someone in subcommittee. The role of LFO staff, just to inform you, is to assist you in this through the time the bills cross each floor. We will assist by writing ponies or little scripts for you to carry the bill in full. Also for the floor sessions, you may or may not want to use them, but we provide them for you. And we also will be there in both full committee and on the side aisle of the floor or at your desk, if you wish, when the bill is being carried. That's to provide just staff support. We ask that you turn off your cell phones and the like, or at least put them on quiet mode, please. And we have more members than we have microphones, so from time to time, we'll be checking with Susan Cook, our committee assistant here. If she hollers that I can't hear you, we'll just have to be sure we speak into the microphones. Rules now require, before a public hearing on any bill, 72 hours notice. These are informational hearings. They're not yet posted as public hearings, but we will post the first public hearing 72 hours in advance for any bill. We will be... After that is 48 hours, and then we will be posting at least 48 hours notice if you are assigned other things. For example, you will be hearing the Public Employees Retirement System Preliminary Earnings Report. It's a report they are required to provide by law, either to Ways and Means during session or to the Emergency Board during the interim, prior to the Board taking final action on crediting earnings to member and employer accounts. You'll be hearing that in a few weeks. There may be other things assigned for approval of federal grant applications, other reports, and maybe other substantive bills that have been referred down to Ways and Means. Generally, though, the budget bills take priority. That's the primary mission of this. So the co-chairs, as they assign the other substantive bills to Ways and Means, they tend to follow the budget bills. You have a list of the budget bills that we expect to be assigned to this subcommittee. I say expect, because the bill yet for, I believe, the E-Fund and for the legislative agencies has not been assigned, at least to subcommittee. The legislative agency bill hasn't yet been assigned to Ways and Means. We feel free to contact any of the staff. I gave you a list of the bills, and the LFO staff, our phone numbers are available on the web, or just call down to the office. You will see various staff will be staffing the various budgets. They are staff that are involved with the agencies throughout the interim. Our job is to gain knowledge of their operations so that we can provide you with support and recommendations and advice. The role of Ways and Means is a little different from those other policy committees quite often. As staff Ways and Means, we are expected to provide recommendations to you. And feel free to ask us for information if you have any questions about particularly, well, if our name's associated with an agency, I can't give you a lot of information about the Employment Relations Board, but I certainly should be able to respond to questions you may have with those agencies that I have budgetary responsibility for, as do the other analysts that are here. And this will hold true in the other subcommittees also. This first week is orientation. We'll be given overviews by a number of agencies. I believe I delivered each of you a memo with an outline for this week. You can expect from us by Friday of each week the next week's schedule. So by day, you'll know what's to be presented, and hopefully you'll be ready for it then. Coffee is not provided, so so we ask that you arrive awake. The co-chairs have adopted a new strategy, if you will, for processing or moving on agency budgets. They've taken a three-tier approach to expediting certain agencies, and it essentially is with agencies that we believe are just essentially budget level, essential budget level, maybe some boards and commissions, it's just operating expenses, a quicker timeline than we've had in the past, fewer questions, and just relying on staff recommendations, in effect, where we expect no problems. Those agencies for coming up first, we will not apply the 2% reduction to the co-chairs. I believe talked to sub-chairs on Friday. They are looking at a 2% reduction for certain agencies, for the subcommittee to target an amount for the subcommittee to efficiency savings, if you will. And the deal is if you get them, subcommittee can reallocate half of it to other priorities it may feel. It doesn't have to be agency specific, but within the subcommittee, we will develop those numbers for you too, and work with the chair, and you guys will then go through the performance measures of agencies and priorities, and then be asked to make decisions on where you want to make some reductions and if you want to make them. Certain things are excluded from that reduction
savings
around. For example, non-limited is a term that is used, and you'll see it here when you see the Public Employees Retirement System and some other budgets. What it is that in their enabling legislation, we give that agency the appropriation. The funds are continuously appropriated for that agency's use, lacking legislative limitation on that, on those funds, the agency can spend anything it has. So we provide what's called expenditure limitation for those. These are other funded agencies. There are non-limited. We in the budget bill itself, we will statutory or in the session law exclude certain type of expenditures from legislative expenditure limitation. And those would be a good example are disbursements out of the trust fund of FERS for benefits. Not for its operations, but just for its benefits. So that way the agency can, if it's more is needed, it can administratively go to budget management and the Department of Administrative Services and seek increase in their allotments or the ability to write the checks. Another non-limited expenditure authority is granted to the Employment Department for payment of unemployment insurance benefits. So those are the types of non-limited expenditures that you'll see. For example, PERS, its budget is about $6.4 billion, and $6.3 of it is non-limited. The other $100 million, or a little less, is for its operations, which are subject to limitation. Getting back to the expedited process for agencies, we'll be working with your sub-chair on those agencies. And you'll know them in advance, and they require, hopefully we'll move through a number of easier agencies first, and then the more difficult or contentious, not contentious, but those that may have policy implications or policy option packages that are dependent upon other legislation will be dealt with in more detail. Staff, again, will make recommendations. The practice, I think, the chairs want kind of some thinking time between public hearings and public testimony and work sessions, so we will probably be scheduling the work sessions about a week after the last public hearing on an agency's budget bill. Not only that serves two purposes, time to think about it and discuss it offline, also time to prepare some paperwork and take into consideration the public testimony. Public testimony generally will be scheduled right at the end of the public hearing and before we go on to work session the week following. Certain agencies, though, we may schedule it. If a larger agency like Department of Administrative Services will take a lot of time, we may schedule a couple of periods of public hearing following certain activities or certain divisional presentations. Again, if you can't make it, we've given you a phone number and a name of someone to call so that they can communicate with Susan or myself that you won't be here, so we can inform the chair. We've given you a list of the agencies and possibly the order which you'll see them. The reviewing agencies will spend a lot of time reviewing their performance measures, how they're operating against those measures, whether they're achieving targets. And they will also be going over in a lot of detail what they view as their priorities for their operation. If you have any questions about the setup committee, feel free to give me a call. I know that. With that, Mr. Chair.
Well, with that, let's pause for a moment and ask if there are any questions this morning.
Representative Meyer. Yes. I just have a comment. I noticed you're mostly addressing this side of the table for all of us newcomers in the awakening process, I think. and I appreciate it. It's a lot of information you just gave us, and so don't be surprised if we repeat a lot of the questions that you just answered.
Senator Bates, did you have
a... just real quick. First off, we need to renegotiate with the co-chairs about the 50% rule. I'll tell you right now, if we find anything here, we want to shift to whatever the budget, and they want 50% of it for their budgets, well, we're going to find 50% only. So we'll have a chit-chat with the co-chairs, okay?
Members of this subcommittee, I feel, however you want to deal with it.
It looks to me also like we've got 8 different members of LFO to work with on these budgets. Is that correct?
You have a whole plethora of staff, yes.
Yeah, that's going to make it a little bit tougher. I'm hoping some of these budgets are small, like some of them probably are, so we'll kind of zip through them. But it's usually you have 3, maybe 4 LFO members to work with. And maybe we've got half the staff down there, so that's going to make it a little more difficult. Those of you who haven't been in Ways and Means before, what I found to be more successful is to set some time aside, go down with the budget. I'm lining my budgets up by staff members. And go down and talk to them about the 4 or 5 they've got and walk through them. Because I've never seen these budgets before. I've seen other budget in the state government accept these. So these are all brand new to me, too, and I'll have to talk to these people. They haven't got a lot of time, and I'm not sure how we should approach each of us one by one or just have a group session down there without a quorum so we can ask a bunch of private questions, and I'll leave it up to them. To you how you want to deal with your side, but I think maybe we'll go down there and one or two at a time. If you haven't got a quorum, and yeah, we don't make it a burden for LFO.
Dallas? I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Chair, we have to avoid the quorum problem, of course, in the public hearings. Not to be secretive about this, but what Senator Bates said is true. A number of these agencies are smaller, and you'll have the staff just maybe in here for one, and some of them may be in the expedited process. But I think trying to get more of you together at the same time with the staff on certain budgets is a very good idea.
But not a quorum, so we could probably get
two and one
would probably work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Or two and two.
Two and two would work.
That's
too.
Still not a quorum.
Is it a quorum for our side since we have to have...
A quorum is two of this body and three
So two of us. Oh, yeah, three. So we can
be two and two.
Slide around that. Okay. And sometimes you have private conversations with them. It's not you're doing anything. You're just learning faster. You can ask a whole bunch of questions and not feel like that was a stupid question. Yeah. You know, in public.
If I may, you just on Friday we distributed the Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of the governor's recommended budget, and in there is a write up for each of the budgets that you'll have before you. I would recommend reading those. It's riveting reading.
I noticed that. That's, summary. Yeah, that's the term I learned from Representative Butler one time when he referred to something I had written. So anyway, I would start with that, and then take your questions from there.
I think spending a weekend trying to memorize it. I think it's patentable as a cure for insomnia. I would appreciate the comments, Senator Bates, in relationship to, you know, our trying to become as informed as we can before we actually get into it. I would advise all members of the committee that we do have, in addition to Dallas, in relationship to all of these budgets, a resident expert who chaired this committee last time, Senator Johnson. So she can expect questions from the chair, and I think if you can catch her in the hall or someplace, she would be available for questions there too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is my fourth tour of duty. It's a glutton for punishment who signs up to do DASS's budget four times in a row. Okay.
So for those people coming in, you know, for DASS, and they're here today, I guess for all of the people who are going to be testifying today, we would understand that Senator Johnson has heard your stories before, and we'll be sitting there with a sharp pen looking for places to find an extra dollar or two. So,
are there any questions? Any other?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Representative Edwards.
You mentioned a phone number. There was a phone number to call if we can't make it or something. I didn't see that.
Yes.
Where is it?
It's on the first page, I believe, of this, I think, Subcommittee on General Government Overview Information. Right, it should have been the first thing underneath your agenda.
The 986-1828.
Oh, I see it.
986-1828.
Okay,
1828 is the general number for Legislative Fiscal Office.
Got it. Thank you.
And you don't give out your
My number is 986-1834.
Are we ready to proceed then? Welcome. Well, before we do, I'd like to welcome you all to the committee. And I think given Senator Bates' comment about the variety of staff we have to work with for any committee that you will be on, you will appreciate as much continuity as you can have with staff is always the a kind of key to being able to move yourself forward. So we've got our hands full, I think, and I do appreciate all of you on the committee. We look forward to working with you. We'll look forward to, you know, starting out with commitment from the governor's office for the 2% budget reduction in the governor's office, and we'll be kind of off and running then this morning with an overview here by the governor's office, the agency overview. The governor's chief of staff, Chip Terhune, is here this morning. Linda Ames from budget, and of course we have Dallas, our advisor, is also here. You're going to be talking about some portion of this.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we were staff intend to be real quiet.
Devin, all right, very good. With that, Chip, would you?
Mr. Chair, I just have a quick question. Adopt rules, or do we not adopt rules?
They've been adopted by the joint committee, the full committee.
And you have a copy of the rules?
Yeah, I have them. I just didn't know at what point we adopted them.
Yeah, we all operate under the same thing, so they don't give us the privilege of doing that. Thank you, though. That is a variation in the normal protocol here. So.
Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Chip Terhune. I'm the governor's chief of staff, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning to talk a little about the overview of the governor's office and the budget. Before I get going, I just want to let you all know that I've been on the job approximately 5 to 6 weeks, and, you know, when I heard Dallas mention that this was an orientation, I was extremely relieved and appreciate the being oriented earlier, actually last week, by Dallas myself. I will tell you, I think you're all in very, very capable hands. Dallas, along with Ken Rocco, have been sort of meeting with us in a series of meetings, and it's been a great learning experience for me, so for what it's worth. Diving right in, recognizing that time is of the essence here, I want to let you know that behind the scenes in the governor's office, there is a team of people that work incredibly hard and are among the most professional I've ever worked with. I've been really, really impressed with how they exercise their responsibilities on behalf of the governor. The executive power of the state of Oregon resides with the governor. He, in essence, serves as the chief executive officer of the state. And if you think about the scope of that, there are about 100 state agencies and about 200, little over 200 boards and commissions, which is a pretty awesome responsibility in many respects. In addition to that, the governor coordinates all interaction in terms of intergovernmental affairs, whether local or federal, and serves a very key role in that. And there are various other duties, including commander of chief of the militia, except when called by the United States, and kind of a variety of other things. But diving down to the task at hand, we thought perhaps the best way to have this discussion would be to provide you with an organizational chart. And during the course of this brief presentation, I'll be sort of referring to this, but we thought it would be valuable for you to have at least a visual reference by which to look at the governor's office and how things interconnect and interplay. So underneath this is the 100 agencies and 200 or so boards and commissions, and it's a fairly significant task to handle all of that, but I think probably the best way to describe it is really in sort of three key roles. The governor's office consists of supporting roles, which you'll find on the left-hand side here, generally, in the org chart. They consist of policy roles, which consist here down below, and then there are also some statutory roles, which are sort of interspersed within the organizational chart. I'll get to those in a second. Summary on the supporting roles is basically things like traditional communications efforts, legislative liaison, federal affairs, pieces like that are sort of in that category. Under the policy side of the equation, the organizational chart really kind of divides out the duties underneath two deputy chiefs of staff. One deputy chief of staff, in this case, Tim Nesbitt, who also joined the governor's office at the same time I did, has responsibilities for education, health, human services, those policy areas there. The other chief of staff, Alan Alley, who started last week, has responsibilities for economic development, transportation, energy, technology, those on that side. The policy roles down below there are, in many respects, the meat, if you will, of the governor's office, and oftentimes what most of the focus certainly externally is, and often internally. If you look down that list, it's relatively comprehensive, but I want to emphasize this is a draft. There are some pieces missing and some pieces that we'll be putting in over the course of the next several weeks. For example, housing is missing, a couple other key ingredients. I just want to mention that as well. In terms of statutory roles, what I'd like to do is just highlight there are really kind of three key statutory roles for the governor's office, and Dallas was kind enough to educate me on a couple of these in our meeting the other day. But the first one is affirmative action. And affirmative action, as you can see, actually lies in the sort of direct report to the chief of staff. This is run by Peggy Ross, whose offices are located in the Department of Administrative Services. She's very, very capable. Really focuses around the enrichment of the workplace through diversity and ensuring that culturally competent leadership exists within state government. Some very important roles there. The other statutory aspect of this that the legislature saw fit to place into the governor's office is under the deputy chief of staff on the far right column, minorities, women, and emerging small business. And I'll get to that in a moment. That's another statutory area. And then the last one is extraditions or arrest and return, which you'll find underneath legal counsel on that document. So those three areas are statutorily housed within the governor's office. So what I'd like to do is just take a couple of these policy areas and highlight them for you, because I think these are the ones that are the least known but very, very significant. The first one is the Office of Rural Policy. The Office of Rural Policy was established by executive order, and in essence, its role is very simply to formulate rural policy for the state. Much more simpler in saying that than doing, but the reality is that that is its responsibility. It has established a list and continues to expand on that list of best practices in solving rural issues. Its goal is to help unify the rural and urban divide that exists in the state and to improve our economy by basically moving economic development into and through rural Oregon. It's also the liaison between rural officials, the governor, and the legislature, and has a rural policy advisory committee, which is made up of many members of the legislature as well. The minorities, women, and emerging small business is another one that I think is intriguing and important. It was created in 1987, and it is responsible for advising the governor on the promotion of economic integration of minorities and women and emerging small businesses into the private sector. There are about 1,600 total certified businesses in those categories. They are certified by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and then they are advocated for and assisted through the governor's office. The rationale behind separating those two is that at some point the legislature felt that there was a potential conflict of interest, and I think wisely felt that, between the certification, if the certification was housed in the exact same place as the advocacy. So the legislature sought to separate those two, and has certification under DCBS, and has the actual advocacy and the day-to-day work done under the governor's office.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry. I don't recall whether or not you said you wanted to take questions at the end or you would entertain them as we move through the presentation.
I would entertain them now, but we...
Colleagues, just as a policy question, this whole business about minority women and emerging businesses, there are pockets of that activity spread out throughout state government. And it has been my experience in the legislature, and this has nothing to do with the governor's office, it's just a policy question. If I'm taking out the phone book as a woman-owned business and deciding where to call to ask for help, I'm mystified. I don't know where to go. And I think bringing some clarity to that would be helpful. We've got pockets of it in ODOT that's required by the federal government in order to receive federal funds. We've got pockets of it in DCBS for the certification. We've got pockets of it in the governor's office for advocacy there. We've got pockets of it in OECDD. And it's something that has confounded me and might be worthy of some additional discussion. If we take this as seriously as we should, we ought to be able to find it in the phone book.
Thank you very much for those comments, Senator. I couldn't agree more with you. It can be very frustrating trying to, even for those of us who may have more familiarity with the system than the public at large would have.
And I just want to end by saying this is not a criticism of the governor's office. This is, I think, having a pocket of it in the governor's office reflects the governor's commitment to helping minority women and emerging businesses succeed in this state. But I just have questioned whether or not we could do it in a more streamlined way across agencies.
Thank you.
The that's a great point. This particular portion of this is really what I would describe as almost the focal point of advocacy and assisting those businesses. It trains vendors on how to compete or how to engage in these businesses in governmental contracts. It also trains in outreach, or excuse me, it actually promotes outreach and basically tries to be the focal point by which minorities and women and emerging small business.
Bill draft on a concept of one form or another. And once you've written up the bill draft on that concept, if there's some question about legality or constitutionality that appears, I come back to the same people who wrote the bill to get an interpretation as to whether or not it is constitutional. And somehow or another, that doesn't seem to me to be the type of thing that one would typically find in the legal profession, that we would be looking for other sources. But that's just for future discussion. You can think about you will hear from me again on it.
Well, Chair.
Thank you.
No response required, is that?
That's right.
Okay. We'll talk about it in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
While you bring your next person, I'd like to make a comment.
Yes, if you could.
Mr. Wayne, we'll take any time. No, you're gone. You're done.
I'm
done. Come on up.
I have been concerned for the last session and a half, not only about Muskogee Council, but about LFO and other agency we use here, that we are trying to run a $11 or $12 billion government on the cheap. So I'm thinking about our own personal staffs being inadequate,
right,
being funded by campaign funds often. I worry about what we're doing to LFO. When you start seeing the kind of turnover you do in staffs, you know you're burning. And you're usually burning through people because you're working them too hard, and you're not paying them enough, and they find other jobs that pay better, better hours, and better time. I think our movement towards an annual session may help that a little bit, but not enough. And it looks like it's going to fall to this committee to look at those issues and bring them back to leadership. And, you know, I looked at this particular one. There's two or three policy questions here. But it begs the question, and Senator Johnson was absolutely right. With I'm passing her note, well, what's going on with this situation here? And she's writing back, we got to find out. I mean, there's more here than meets the eye. And if we don't have good people in LC on a regular basis, we don't retain those people because you're going to get them trained up and leave. If we don't do the same thing with LFO, if those staffs aren't big enough to do the job, then we're working blind. I mean, we don't have time to look at a $10, $12 billion budget. I've never gone out to DHS and looked at all the places in the state where we do business. I take the word of LFO that what they give us is much, you know, is correct and appropriate and real. But if they're understaffed, they don't know that either. And I'm worried about the staffing on Volker's departments. I'm worried about the staffing in our offices.
Yeah.
And I'm worried about how much time we put with this, too.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greens. I share those concerns with you. And with that, I probably should mention that we've had a change of staff from LFO to, as they come in for this session, we've got Teresa McEwen now with us. And I'm still scratching my head wondering how Rocco was smart enough to be able or to coerce her or con her or whatever it was to get down in this particular area of state government. Certainly, Teresa, it's an incredible asset to LFO. You will be, or you are, an incredible asset. And I could make the same comment, I think, about the gentleman whose time I'm taking now, Paul Warner, with Legislative Revenue Office. So I'll shut up, Paul, and let you get through realizing that you're one of the pros around here, and you'll be able to help dig me out of the hole that I have created as far as the time elements are concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and have just provided you one page front and back overview of the Legislative Revenue Office. The front page just goes through some of the highlights from the budget document, and then the back is just the organizational chart. So a couple things about the office. We were created in 1975. We have been fortunate to have a lot of stability, at least particularly in the revenue officer position. I'm the third legislative revenue officer, Rich Mund, and then Jim Scherzinger and myself. We have 6 FTE, which is what we had in 1975. So we have stayed at that level. It's myself and 4 economists, an office manager on a permanent basis, and then we staff up with clerical staff during the session that comes out of the assembly budget. Our mission is to provide objective, unbiased research and analysis on revenue issues. We do, of course, my appointing authority and statute is our revenue chairs, the House and Senate revenue chairs, but we do take direction from the legislature in general, and we work a lot with the public during the interim, particularly on revenue-related initiatives, like Measure 41, for example, that we had in this last election cycle. We'll spend a lot of time on research of that and outreach and trying to get that information out to various groups and provide research reports that might help voters at least objectively look through those various proposals and what their impact might be. We do try to provide, in terms of the session itself, we spend most of our time on revenue impact statements, and we're looking at that process and trying to make that a little bit more clear and easier to use. That's our key statutory responsibility is to review each bill and prepare a revenue impact statement on that. On performance measure criteria, we have argued, similar to LFO, really, that there isn't a good quantitative measure of what we do. It's really the users of our information, decision makers who rely on it, and that really means you, basically. So I think probably the best way to assess our performance is to look at overall surveys, and we had one done in the interim, and I've just summarized those results there on the most general question. In terms of the 07-09 period, we're one of the things, of course, that we have always in the background, and the nature of our revenue system being, compared to most around the country, being an unbalanced revenue system, we continually have major proposals to change that system. And we do spend a lot of our time on that. We try to improve our ability to evaluate those proposals. And we think that we have, with some of the tools at our disposal, particularly our Oregon Tax Incidence Model, we have some of the best in the country as far as analyzing some of those big changes. Now, whether those actually ever take place or not, I don't know, Mr. Chair, but we certainly have interest in it, and I suspect we'll continue to, given the nature of our system. As we look ahead for the over the longer term, our 6-year plan, really, and I think you just listening in on discussion with legislative counsel and our chief counsel, The key issue for any of these, of course, ours is considerably smaller than our two sister agencies, but the key to success is to maintain a quality skilled staff, and that's something we really emphasize and really try to do, make sure that the folks we have not only have the analytical skills to, and we like to think of our folks as being capable of doing economic analysis at a high academic level, but also being able to communicate that and communicate it to our policymakers. So we emphasize those things and try to continue to work on them. Just on the back side, you can see how our organization is laid out, our current revenue chairs, and our four economists, and in the way we've laid out our staff. In terms of kind of areas of expertise, we've typically divided up among our major revenue areas, property tax, income tax, and then school finance. We've done the school distribution formula on the revenue committee and spent a lot of time on that. Then we have kind of a catch-all, which is our excise taxes, and that's where we're getting a lot of the growth, I think, in some demand, as there's a lot of proposals to try to get revenue from various activities, various excise tax proposals. So we've also seen a lot of interest in lottery, of course. It's grown in magnitude as a revenue source. We spent a lot of time trying to evaluate that revenue source and what's its long-term stability and what's its long-term revenue yield likely to look like. We have had some turnover. We have a new office manager. Robin Wilton has come to us this past interim. That's gone very smoothly. We replaced an office manager we had for over 20 years, Kim James, who many of you worked with. So, but I think those kinds of transitions, we've been very fortunate, and they've gone pretty smoothly.
Thank you, Paul. Quick question, Representative Paul.
I have two quick questions, and I'll roll it into one.
All right. That's
What happened to Elizabeth? And work? And do you? Does your office work closely with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis on the forecast? So that when we, I mean, more minds going into making that forecast happen?
Representative Crummell, the answer to the first question is Elizabeth went to the dark side, and that means Olympia from us, our major competitors. In fact, she...
That is the dark side.
So, we didn't know if she was going to realize a large capital gain, and then she just moved over there. No, it was... Actually, it was a family decision. She went to work for their Department of Revenue and just emailed us a few weeks ago. She has changed jobs and gone to work for the Washington legislature. So she's staying on the legislative branch side, but it was a family decision. Elizabeth came to us out of Purdue, out of graduate school, and had really developed, and that was a difficult loss for us. The other personnel change for us that was difficult was losing Ed Waters, who had come and done a lot of our work on OTIM, and ended up working up with Pacific Marine Fisheries Board. And most of those decisions have really been family ones in terms of location around Salem, I think. But we've been fortunate. Chris Allenack has come to us from Department of Revenue. He's in the research section for 10 years, and he's able to step in and very extensive knowledge of the income tax system. And the other question, Representative Crummell, is working with the Office of Economic Analysis. We have interpreted our role and the role of the revenue committees really as to review and oversight of that process. If you go back to the documentation from the late 70s and early 80s that created that office, it really came out of the work of the Legislative Revenue Office of Rich Mon at that time, and there was a discussion about who should have responsibility for the forecast. And if you look at a number of states, you have dual forecasts. You have the executive providing one and the legislative providing one. And the thought at that time, and I completely agree with it, and I think it's still very relevant, is that that's a highly inefficient way to do things. And what you should do is kind of divide up those responsibilities. So that's what we've done, and the executive branch has responsibility of providing the current law forecast. We help review that forecast in two venues. One is we have a person on their economic advisory board. And one of the things that reviews the economic assumptions, and then one of the outgrowths of the 01-03 crash was Administrative Revenue Advisory Board that just takes the economic variables and says, okay, that forecast is given. What does this tell us in terms of the revenue patterns? We look at, you know, withholding patterns. We look at estimated payments, and we look at, you know, the subcomponents of income like capital gains. And I'm actually a member of that, and so is Chris Alanak on my staff. So we do work closely with them and spend a lot of time with them. And, of course, what we do in terms of the revenue impact of proposals, we have sole responsibility for that. And we'll take their advice and talk with the revenue department about their view on things, but we have responsibility for that number. So that's kind of how our system works, and I think that's been a good system.
Okay. I have 15 minutes to 30 minutes worth of testimony. And I don't know. We're going to have to then call the halt. Well, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure many of the questions that members have will be saved for when your budget gets here. We'll have them.
Very well, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Karen Quigley with the Commission on Indian Affairs. Thank you. Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Quigley, and I'm the Executive Officer of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, and I apologize for trying to impersonate Paul Warner. I was just hoping to rush you through your schedule. And I do thank you for giving me the opportunity to give you a very brief summary of the Commission on Indian Services. And I have given you a couple of pieces of information. One is most of what I'd like to touch on today, and in the event I'm not able to, a key contact directory which deals with the 30 state agencies that have a significant amount of interaction with Oregon's tribal governments and their tribal counterparts. The Commission on Indian Services is an advisory body that was formed 31 years ago to be, as Senator Johnson was touching on earlier, for affirmative action. It is the central point for Indian issues for the state of Oregon. And I've been executive officer for 11 years, and this period has coincided with a significant growth and development of Oregon's tribal governments, and a lot of this stems from federal legislation and federal policy to promote tribal self-governance and self-determination. The effect is the state has to do a lot more with tribes than it had to in the past. So the role of the office and the commission, I think, has grown significantly. And probably the most significant aspect of it is it's supposed to help the state avoid litigation. In all 43 states that have federally recognized tribes, there's some equivalent to this commission. But this commission is seen as the primo in terms of the nation of working things out by communicating ahead of time before there's a crisis and avoiding unnecessary time in court and legal fees. And believe me, a number of other states spend a horrendous amount of money duking it out in court, and Oregon's tried to avoid that, and for the most part has been very, very successful. The commission is a 13-member body that are jointly appointed, all the members, by the Senate President and the Speaker of the House. Senator Kate Brown is one of two legislators. She's been there so long that the chair of the commission still refers to her as Representative Brown because she was a representative when she started, and Representative Tom Butler. Then nine members, an elected official from each of the governing bodies of the tribal governments in Oregon, and two seats are for the large non-reservation, what are sometimes referred to as urban Indians. There's an office in the Capitol for the two staff members, myself and a commission assistant, and we handle the day-to-day information inquiries. And I am involved on a daily basis in phone, email, and in-person consultations on with state agencies, local governments, the public, legislators, and for when an Indian issue comes up. To get through this quickly, please feel free to contact me anytime, and I'd be happy to discuss this with you some more. In terms of what the commission does, some of the main activities, the commission as a full body holds quarterly meetings. This upcoming meeting, we hope to have a discussion with local government and the Office of Rural Policy to focus on some of the issues affecting rural Oregon that local government and the tribes have to deal with on a daily basis. The commission hosts a Tribal Information Day. It organizes an annual summit with elected officials, tribal leaders, and agency directors, tribal staff, agency staff, to work on the main priority issues. For example, one was meth and gangs. Another was providing or creating a healthy environment for our children, and another getting to college, getting jobs. So these are the 10 sovereigns within the borders of Oregon want to see where they can address common issues using the limited resources of all 10 governments. The commission reviews the annual agency reports, which detail the specific activities each of those 30 agencies have had with tribes. They are my bedside reading right now. They should be up on our website shortly. I encourage you, particularly if there's any agency that you want to know about and how they are working with tribes, please check our website out. There's a lot of other information, including training materials I have here, links to tribal websites, and a lot of other contact information in the directories that our office produces. I monitor legislative proposals. Just to give you one example, last session there was a proposal for the interoperability of emergency communication requested by the state police that included every single government that you could think of but did not include tribal governments, which is a little ironic given the fact that, for example, in the Chair's district, the Umatilla tribe is designated as an evacuation site for the Umatilla Chemical Depot and their chemical burning operation, and is also their hazmat operation covers tribal and non-tribal lands in and around Pendleton. Tribe on the Coast is an official evacuation site for tsunami. Doesn't it make sense to have them involved in the emergency communication? So a lot of time, and I went through the bill packet. There's a bill on the same topic this session. It does include tribal government. So this is how we work it out. The commission also provides annual training that's required by law for agency managers that deal with tribes, as well as providing consultation speeches and information packets for schools, universities, local governments, the public, and anyone else who may be interested in what the commission does or about state tribal issues in Oregon. I just, to finish, would like to just mention a couple of things where you might find some value or use because this state has a commission. Legislative committee called me last week, as several do, wanting to know a person to represent the interests of the tribe in a particular area to have a discussion with the committee. A number of legislators contact me because they get a comment or a question from a constituent that has to do with an Indian issue, and they'd like some suggestions on how they might respond. State agencies are often required to consult with tribes because of the dictates of some federal legislation or some tie-in with federal money. Officially, the Commission on Indian Services has the authority to designate the appropriate Indian tribe. So as Senator Johnson was mentioning, if there's some reason a state agency has to know who to talk to, my position is the one that is authorized to say who they need to talk with. And there are a number of also state laws that have a requirement for consultation, so the state has one place to find that out. State agencies have a place to check ahead of time when they're designing a policy that might affect tribal interests. In addition, they can use the commission meetings as a place to roll out an official policy, so they can hit the top policymakers and as tribal leaders of those governments to get their reaction and to sort of set up a way to get some feedback from them. Legislators and state agencies, the governor's office, also have one place where they can get in contact if they need an individual to be appointed to a board or commission, to provide an invocation for a meeting, to have someone come speak to their group about tribal history or a particular tribe's government structure. So, again, using Senator Johnson's example of the efficiencies but also the productivity in having one point of contact, one clearinghouse, one place to get some advice and to assist in strategizing to make as positive interactions as we can between the state and tribal governments.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, and we will forego any questions if members have some. I think you've given them the clue, and so we'll move on.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Henderson. Oh, it's getting harder and harder to get me out of that hole.
I'll help as much as I possibly can.
Okay. Mr. Chair. The worst thing that I've done, of course, members, is that I've left the head of the legislative fiscal here as the last one, and so I get off started on the wrong foot with legislative fiscal chief officer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I don't want to take any of Mr. Rocco's time, so I will be brief. I am Dave Henderson, legislative administrator. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. You are getting a one-page document that outlines the structure of legislative administration. The Legislative Administration Committee was created in 1969. It is a nine-member committee co-chaired by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. The Senate President appoints three senators, the Speaker of the House appoints four representatives, and jointly that committee oversees the operations of the agency known as the Legislative Administration. We provide services through six functional units, which are shown on the org chart on the front of the handout, and there's a little bit of text about those offices on the backside, and let me just briefly run through that and describe the functions of those offices, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions. The administrator's office oversees the general operation of legislative administration. It consists of myself, Daniel Russell, who is our web editor, and Julene Poppinga, who is our building use coordinator. We also have visitor services, which is based in the kiosk out in the middle of the building that you see the volunteers, and there's only, I think, three or four paid staff in that office, but it's run largely with volunteers. So that's all part of the administrator's office. The committee services office is the office that provides the support to the standing committees. We don't staff fiscal or revenue committees, but we do staff all of the standing committees with generally a committee administrator and a committee assistant assigned to each office. The legislative library and public access room is part of committee services. That is a research facility for you and your staff, as well as providing public access computers so that members of the public can come in, do research, draft testimony, and interact with you as legislators. Information Systems is the office that runs all of the computing systems in the building, as well as the closed circuit TV system. They take care of your personal computers in your office, the local area network, the mainframe computer on which we're still doing bill drafting, and then, as I said, one office within Information Systems is Media Services, which runs the cameras and produces copies of CD copies or DVD copies of hearings as you request them. Facility Services is the operation that takes care of the building. They do all of the operations and maintenance, which includes running the heating ventilation system, They helped you get settled in your offices as you moved from office to office. They run the telephone systems, the custodial services, and they also operate through legislative publications and distribution, the office that distributes all of the official legislative publications as well as provides supplies for your offices. Through contract, we operate the cafe in the basement. That's a private vendor that is operated through a contract with Facility Services. And through a contract with the Oregon State Police, we provide security for the Capitol. Employee Services is the office that handles all human resource functions for the legislature. Hiring, benefits, everything of that nature that is handled through that office. And then finally, Financial Services is the office that handles all of our budgeting and accounting for both legislative administration and for the Assembly and certain portions of that work for the other legislative support agencies. We do accounts payable, accounts receivable. You get a weekly report from them, I think, during session, a monthly report during the interim as to the balance in your actual individual accounts as 90 legislators. And that is a 30,000-foot overview of legislative administration. And I would be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Dave. We will, I think, forego questions until we get the budget in here. And I'm sure members have got a bunch of them that they've accumulated as far as questions, and they'll bring it that time.
Thank you very much.
And are you subbing?
Well, I'm sure that's him at the door. I'm sure he was watching.
I thought that probably would be the case. Good morning, Mr. Rocco. Sorry to inconvenience you by having you late. You should have envisioned this and had your staff schedule you in person on this committee.
Thanks.
With this inexperienced chair.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I asked them to have me scheduled last, so that maybe I wouldn't have to do this.
With that, you can make it as short or long as you choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or is this called saving the best for last?
Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. I've given you a couple things that I'm just briefly going to talk about. One is a PowerPoint. Some slides from a PowerPoint that describe our office and what we do. There's a list of staff and program areas that they're responsible for. And then the folded document is a business plan exercise that we went through this interim, trying to look at what we're going to work at in the next 2 year cycle. Basically, the Legislative Fiscal Office was created in 1959, and it's a nonpartisan, permanent, professional staff office. As you're probably aware, our primary responsibilities during session are to help craft the budget, the state's balanced budget. And to do that, we produce various reports for the Assembly. We just released an analysis of the governor's budget, summary document, and a agency-by-agency detailed document that you should have all received Friday, I believe. We have 19 permanent positions in the office. We've undergone some transformations over the past couple years to get rid of a rotation program that we used to have to bring in two or three analysts from agencies. And we just for session, we found that wasn't working very well. So last session we got approval to transfer those rotation positions into permanent staff. Our budget, our 05-07 budget is about $4.8 million general fund. There's an org chart in the handout that just shows that we're relatively flat organization. We have three levels of analysts and then a deputy fiscal officer and the fiscal officer, two support staff. We provide staff support to the Ways and Means Committee. And then during the interim, we staff the support to the Ways and Means Committee, and then during the interim, we staff the audit, Joint Legislative Audit Committee, the Joint Information Management Technology Committee, and the Emergency Board. Our business plan that we developed, I think the noteworthy part is some of the actions we're planning for 07-09. Which includes review of the budget statutes. We're thinking of doing that in the interim because over the years they've been added to, taken away from, and we thought it might be time to give an overview of those statutes and see if there could be some cleaning up of them. And another important thing that we're looking at doing is developing some data audits on performance measures. I think one of the gaps in that system right now is the quality of the data that agencies bring forward. So we're going to develop a plan to do that.
You will be very welcome. Questions for Mr. Rocco? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Crummer.
No, it's okay. I'll wait.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you. And my apologies, members. I will try always to get you out of here on time. Got away from you today, and so 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Thank you. We are adjourned.